Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North over in the UK. How are you, Martin?
Yeah, pretty good. Interesting times, a lot going on, and we had the JFK papers out overnight. So who knows what's going to happen next?
I know, Martin. I've got my favorite conspiracy t-shirt on, Fight Against the New World Order, because this is amazing. The JFK files showing, the CIA's involvement in Israel and so on. And a lot of people thought, maybe we'd never see this. And I don't know. What do you think? Trump's talking about maybe releasing the 9/11 files and the Epstein list. And what's your take on all this?
Well, I think it's going to get lost in a lot of the noise. I mean, there are so many counter threads to what's going on at the moment, and he promised to be more transparent. Well, we'll see. Wherever you look, there's question marks. We have a new Canadian Prime Minister who wasn't elected. How does that work?
Yeah, maybe even a Western Australian leader who might not have been elected. So, as you say, it's wild times, and it's exciting to cover it all. Well, let's dive into these fantastic slides of yours. So, first up, you've got global debt.
Yeah, I just wanted to table this. This is, of course, the continuing story that people need to understand. The amount of debt sloshing around the world is continuing to rise. And interestingly, the International Finance Institute a little while ago said increasing trade tensions could undermine growth prospects while lifting government interest costs and deepen fiscal strains. And now that was before the Trump saga started. And debt's still rising faster. Remember that debt equals liquidity. Liquidity equals the devaluation of the dollar, whether it's the Aussie dollar or the US dollar, relative to other assets. And it's important, I think, people understand the context for what's going on at the moment. Nobody has got this debt issue under control. And in fact, if you go to the next slide, this was quite an interesting one I discovered, which just showed that there is a significant concentration of debt in the US, more than 34.55%. That's the global debt. Japan at 10%, China at 16%, a little Australia down there just showing up, but hardly at all. But what's also interesting on this slide is it's showing you the relative proportion to GDP. And of course, Japan is holding one of the prizes there, and but other countries too. So there is a very important context for all this discussion about what's happening and the level of uncertainty. Markets don't like uncertainty, but the story about debt is probably the biggest level of uncertainty of them all.
Absolutely. And we've both been talking about that for a long time, and now it's starting to, I guess, reach the headlines with everything else that's going on with these trade wars and whatnot.
Yeah, and you've segued very nicely into the next slide, which is, of course, that the trade wars are now boiling up. The OECD put out a report, said that that would actually push growth backwards, and they've made some projections there. It's forecasting down growth, in a number of different countries. Obviously, difficult to know how this can play out because nobody quite knows where the Trump tariffs are going to end. There's more coming. It looks to me as though Australia is not going to avoid it. And there were a lot of politicians making kowtowing gestures towards the US, saying, "Oh, we're different. We shouldn't be hit." But I'm afraid that it looks as though the tariffs are going to be there. And of course, the question is then, well, what's the second order effect? So are you going to get flows the other way? Are you then going to get more coming back? And Trump is basically saying, "Well, if you put tariffs on me, I'm going to put more tariffs on you." So this is just starting out. And the context for our later discussion about markets is markets don't like uncertainty, right? And the degree of uncertainty that this tariff situation is now creating, not just in the US, but globally, is highly significant and important. And that's one of the reasons why, as we'll see, that people have been trying to rebalance their portfolios, maybe away from the US, maybe into gold or other places, because what the assumed future would be is now being questioned.
Absolutely. And as you said, Australia not immune. Maybe some of the headlines aren't as bad as we thought with Australia, but what's your take on this?
Well, Chalmers, of course, came out a week before the budget he didn't want to have, of course, because the recent storms and around Brisbane basically stopped them going to an election early, so they're going to run full term now. But he basically said, "Look, it's small impact, 0.1% hit, maybe, but who knows what the second order effects are?" And he did actually admit, "We don't know. We don't really know." And in fact, Sarah Hunter at the RBA recently made a a comment that said, look, it's very difficult. We're running scenarios because we don't know where these are going to play out and how deep they're going to be. But what we can hypothesize is that inflation will be higher than we expected. Debt will be higher. Growth will be lower. And the rebalancing of the world order means, well, you know, who do we trust? Who do we want to work with? You know, is the US the partner of choice that it has been for so long for Australia and for other countries too? You know, look at what's happening with regard to Ukraine. Interesting that Canada is now saying, well, they want to be the strongest non-European European, as it were. It's amazing. Just this sort of reshifting of power bases and reshifting of priorities. The markets don't know what to do. And that's why I think we're seeing markets beginning to react relatively negatively, particularly in the US.
Absolutely. It's a very unique time. So the Aussie stock market's taken a real hit.
Yeah, and I started with these charts here just on the Aussie situation, just to give you a bit of a flavour. So, you know, markets, they bounced a little bit, then dropped back again today. We're in correction territory now, around 10% lower. And pretty much across the board and pretty much all sectors, maybe other than gold miners. Also, it's worth noting that the interest rate, the two-year, which is a sort of a proxy for the future cash rate, well, it's come back a little bit from, it was close to four, but it's still relatively high and relatively stable. And so the expectation is that maybe we're not going to get any more rate cuts, or if they do, it's going to be limited. The RBA will make a decision in April. Inflation came down a little, but it's still a bit sticky. And now, of course, these trade tensions are actually really coming to the fore. On the next slide, you can see there the Aussie dollar has slid against the US dollar. You know, since last year, we're up at 69, going back to the late October. But now, if you look up in March, we're at 63, give or take a little bit. That, of course, does have a benefit to Australia because it means that any of the profits from US dollars, when they're translated into Aussie dollars, actually lifts, and that's one of the reasons why the Treasurer was able to say, well, you know, this is not just a one-way street. On the other hand, of course, it means that any imports that are priced in dollars are more expensive, and that could have an impact on things like oil prices. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. And then if you just think about how that plays out ahead, we've got an election that tends to be an uncertain time. We've got both sides of politics basically chucking rocks at each other, but really not tackling the critical issues, which of course are to do with the cost of living and those sorts of things. We'll probably get some further handouts in the budget showing that, quote, being responsible but still actually able to help on the cost of living front, except, of course, as we'll see shortly, there are impacts for the broader economic situation in Australia because of the high debt and everything else. If we go across to the US and just follow the same sort of logic, NASDAQ is into correction territory now as well. Maybe no surprise, we had that massive run-up last year thanks to AI. And Tesla, of course, has come way back down on the next slide. And interestingly, now some people are questioning whether Elon Musk can still remain the head of Tesla, bearing in mind the conflicts that are implicitly there. And in fact, so, some people now say, I never want to drive a Tesla because of what Elon's doing elsewhere. So there's big questions here about, you know, the future of electronic vehicles and Tesla in particular.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, it was funny last week in our research group, we're joking that Trump might come out and try and pump Tesla stock because it's down 50%+. And the next day he spoke about making the White House lawn a Tesla showroom. But then this morning we got more reports that multiple Teslas were all on fire and we don't really know what happened. But there just seems to be so much going on around that. And as you say, Elon's, I don't know how he does it, if he actually does it all, or it's kind of, you know, it's a bit of a front for who's really running things and doing all this, but it's wild how much he's involved in world politics.
Now. Well, I tell you a little interesting anecdote that I heard on the BBC yesterday, and that is that people from Tesla wrote to the government saying, these tariffs are not good for our business, right? Nobody was prepared to sign that letter. That tells you a lot.
Power is shifting everywhere at the moment. But,
it is.
NVIDIA and semiconductors also a bit weaker.
Yeah, and of course they had a massive run-up. And despite the fact that they're still talking about quite strong growth from a sales perspective, you know, the rate of growth is not anything like it was. And so there's now a question as to And I mentioned this some months ago. You know, we were in the situation where these AI stocks were way, way overvalued and they had a huge impact on the overall market. Well, now we're finding that maybe that's not a one-way street anymore. And, you know, there's still potential for AI, but, well, has the AI promise in terms of valuations, you know, been translated? Not yet. And, of course, we've now got other competition from China and other things like that. So the AI story is quite interesting.
A lot of people have been a bit more skeptical as well of AI with Elon having so much power and talking about Neuralink, and people are going, well, hold on, I don't know if I want this dystopian future if you're wanting to chip us all and everything's going to be run by AI. That's another interesting angle as well.
Yeah, look, AI has the potential to be quite positive, I think, in some areas, but also there are huge risks and huge negativities, and we've got to try and balance the two. The truth is, of course, that the real value of AI is not in pumping up the AI stocks. It's actually implementing it inside businesses to make them more effective, more efficient, or whatever. But actually, the story is it's not that simple. And, you know, we still have hallucinations in AI, and depending on which AI engine you use, you might get different versions of the truth. So we're not actually able to anchor this to what reality is. And that's another point. A lot of people are getting quite skeptical. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out ahead.
Cool. So US 2-year rates?
Yeah, just talk about that. So I highlighted the fact that, you know, our rates were roughly sideways, but, you know, the US rates are rising. The Fed, of course, is meeting at the moment and will make a decision. They probably won't do anything on rates. But the interesting issue with the Fed will be what they will be talking about in terms of their future projections. Will they project a weaker economy in the US, which is quite possible? Some of the indicators in the US are not looking very flash, particularly consumer confidence and also business confidence. And even some of the producer price numbers were quite strong. The inflation numbers weren't that bad, but they weren't really suggesting significant issues with regards to the need to raise rates, but not necessarily cut rates. So I think the Fed will sit on the sidelines for a bit. And the markets are saying, well, maybe one, maybe two, maybe three this year in terms of future cuts. But look, it's all off the table. It depends. Tariffs could well be inflationary. And, you know, whilst Trump is saying, oh, no, it's international people who are paying, at the end of the day, consumers pay. And as we'll see, there is some data that's showing that consumer confidence is relatively low in Australia, but it's also true in the US. And in fact, the Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey went way up in terms of inflation expectations and way down in terms of consumer confidence. And also, the jobs numbers aren't looking flash and employment's a little higher than it was, employment's a little higher. So a lot of uncertainty. I think the Fed will sit on the sidelines.
Yeah, I was just going to add those rates are more important than ever because of the staggering amount of debt the US has to roll over this year. So it makes a big difference if they're at 4-3%, that type of thing.
Yeah, and we should just mention, of course, that they avoided a shutdown again with some horse trading. But that's just a temporary situation. There's still a big question about how much the savings from Doge is actually going to really be. A lot of fictitious numbers being thrown around the place. Debt's still going to rise, and it could rise even faster. There's some tax cut questions coming through in the US as well, and how they're going to fund those tax cuts. So, yeah, US debt will continue to rise. Inflation will be quite a lot stronger, I think, and interest rates will remain higher, which is not good for ordinary households.
Okay, moving on. So the US dollar.
Yeah, it's worth just reflecting on this. Of course, the US dollar was touching 110. This is on the DXY. Now we're down to 103. Now, a weaker dollar, stronger dollar, is that good or bad? You know, people were saying, well, if the dollar gets too strong, that could wreck the economy. If it gets too weak, you know, I'm not sure it makes a lot of difference to the US dollar. But there is a question about the preeminence of dollar. As we've said on many, many occasions, you know, the US dollar is the cornerstone, the linchpin of the global markets. The US has benefited from that for a long, long time. Is that likely to change? Well, we'll see. I think it's too soon to know. But we do know, of course, that in the multipolar world, in the BRICS world, in the world where central banks are buying gold big time, there's a lot of uncertainty below the surface. And so it will be fascinating to see how these exchange rates move. But as we said earlier on, it hasn't really had a good impact on the Aussie dollar. And of course, we do a lot in US dollars in Australia. So we are definitely trade exposed and directly exposed to what happens to the US dollar. And we're not sure where it's going to go from here.
Absolutely. Yeah, good point about Aussie banks being reliant on overseas funding in US dollars a lot of the time.
This is actually the European stocks. So now this is important, right? Because relative to the US, European stocks have actually done quite a lot better since the start of the year, which is remarkable. It's a remarkable turnaround because everyone was saying, "Oh, run from the euro, run from European stocks." But now that's all changed. So there's a big rotation going on at the moment, and in fact, a lot of investors are skipping from the US and buying into Europe or indeed into Asia. And so we are seeing some different dynamics. And you know, the index, if you compare the stock 600 with, for example, the S&P 500, big change. So there's a rotation going on. And just to sort of anchor that, if you look at the DAX in Germany, the DAX is pretty much an all-time high. And they announced a huge stimulus program over the weekend, a big lift in defense spending, a big lift in infrastructure spending. So they've changed and broken some of their debt break rules, which means that effectively we're going to see, guess what, more debt in the Eurozone, right? And so you've got to ask the question, don't they understand what more debt does?
Well, I just wonder if this is part of the playbook with all the globalists and whatnot, if the US is going to pass the baton to Europe and say it's time for you to pick up the tab in terms of military spending, boots on the ground, and everything. And Germany, are they going to ramp up weapons manufacturing? And this is just such an interesting time to be alive with what's going on in Ukraine and Israel.
And of course, the defense stocks have pretty much around the world have gone through the roof. BAE Systems is one I've been looking at quite closely. Interestingly, a lot of investors don't want to invest in the defense sector. And it's quite interesting if you look at the distribution from an age perspective, it's actually older investors who are more anti investing in defense than younger investors, which I think is quite fascinating. So we're interested to see how that plays out. Now, because of the movement in the dollar, the euro against the dollar has gone the other way and is quite a lot stronger than it was, which is again another of these interesting and somewhat seismic shifts. So the point for this month is these movements are massive. These are not normal. These are very abnormal. That's why the markets are quite concerned about what's going on, and nobody quite knows how this is going to play out.
Yeah, as you say, a 5% move in these multi-trillion dollar currencies that are traded around the world is very different to a 5% move in other asset classes.
And remember that on these such big moves, it's the hedge funds and it's the traders who are making huge amounts of money because they've taken positions and are leveraging the system through options and other derivatives. And so this is not good use of, and it's not necessarily good outcomes, but it is actually now the big play. So if you look at what's happening with puts and calls and all those things, they've moved dramatically. And so traders are actually making a field day out of it. I think ordinary people are just being crushed by it though, and that's the problem. We're not having enough focus on the real impact of real economies on real businesses and real consumers and all this, and the talking heads, of course, on all of the various channels that talk about all of this, just talk about the markets all the time. Well, what about reality?
Yeah, I might have a bit of a rant when we get to some of the Australian stuff, Martin, but Bitcoin's been just chopping around the low 80s.
So it's interesting. Of course, we were up at over 100,000 US at one stage, and now it's back down again. It's worth, I think, saying that the Trump strategic Bitcoin reserve wasn't quite what people hoped it might be. So it's basically saying, well, we've already got these Bitcoins that we actually got through various cases that, we cryptocurrency seize stuff, and we're going to actually now manage them, which is wasn't quite what people thought. So I don't know what your take is because you follow this very closely, but I think a lot of people in the Bitcoin community were a bit disappointed with what he came out with.
I think it was a bit disappointing for sure, but what I think we're going to see is the pushback, and I think this is something we're going to see for all legislation. I think we're going to see it push towards the states. So whether it's abortion or gun laws or Bitcoin strategic reserves, Texas came out and said we're going to buy $500 million worth of Bitcoin. So I think Trump's going to try and play the, hey, we're trying to make budget cuts. We can't be seen wasting billions of dollars to buy Bitcoin. let's put it on the states or try and make some budget neutral ways to acquire more Bitcoin is the way they've framed it. So it's not a negative, it's not really super bullish as we'd hoped, somewhere in the middle.
And I don't know whether you saw Peter Schiff, of course, the gold bull, came out and said, well, what you should be doing, you should be measuring Bitcoin in terms of gold. And he's arguing that, of course, Bitcoin's gone down even further if you measure it with gold. And, you know, well, gold has gone up, true. You know, if you look at the chart there, it's knocking out, you know, 3,040 or thereabouts and all-time highs. Again, you need to understand the dynamics here. We've got central banks buying. There's huge amounts of gold being shifted from London via Switzerland and then being taken into COMEX. That's partly to get around some of the potential tariffs, but also the arbitrage opportunity between the futures markets and options markets and the physical gold markets. They are melting down gold from London in Switzerland because the COMEX gold block is different from you couldn't make this stuff up. And I was talking to somebody the other day who actually works in the City of London. They have traffic jams because there are so many big delivery vans outside the Bank of England as they whip the gold out and take it overseas. So I don't know. And this is another example of craziness. And, you know, this is not normal again. This is massive run up. 25% up this year is, you know, remarkable. How high can it go? Nobody knows. You know, there are some people talking 5,000 US for gold. And that's certainly potentially feasible. On the other hand, if things start to move another way, it could be oversold. So who knows? Nobody quite knows. What I can tell you is that the gold bulls are having a great time at the moment. They feel as though they were finally justified.
Yeah, and good on them. I think gold is the ultimate asset in all these times of uncertainty. And I'll be going to be interested to see how Bitcoin behaves as we get later on to the year if these kind of uncertain conditions continue. But I also think silver is the one that hasn't gone yet. And there's a lot of talk about, are these, again, states going to issue new currencies backed by gold and silver? You know, what happens with that audit if it's not all there and all that type of thing? So there's plenty of tailwinds that can push precious metals higher going forward as well.
Yeah, and just one other thing, as we've touched on briefly on in euro, the euro, e-euro, is coming. It's coming later in the year. That's something to watch because, of course, the US has said, "Well, no, we're not going to do an E US dollar." But effectively, I think this could be another sign of some further significant changes. And your hypothesis that maybe the buck is being passed back to Europe at the moment to sort of continue to drive down that global agenda of a a digital currency in opposition to Bitcoin is something to watch. Not sure how it's going to play out, not sure what the implications are, but I thought that was interesting. And I will just make the point, in the fact sheet from Trump, he did actually start by saying, Bitcoin referred to as digital gold. So there is actually an interesting connection point there too.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm glad to hear Trump talking positively about it. And I guess the other connection there with the digital ID with central bank digital currencies and AI, it all kind of ties in together to this scary surveillance world. I think most people want to avoid at all costs.
Absolutely. Now, talking about things we should be avoiding at all costs, there was a very good article by Chris Richardson in the Fin Review. And they asked him to basically write a long piece about what was going on with finances in Australia ahead of the budget. And he basically came out and said, we wasted $400 billion as a windfall, and now we're going to have to pay. And this is if you have not seen this article, it is worth reading in detail because he makes some very interesting points. But just quickly, the central bank debt at the moment in Australia at 35% compared to GDP is quite low. And you can see there that Japan is 206, you know, Greece 185, and, you know, even the US is sitting around 112. So we have some headroom on one angle. But if you look at it on the next slide, this is the really killer slide. If you look at the living standards, Australian living standards, the one on the left-hand side is from 2022 to September 2024. And you can see there that we've dropped 8.3%. We're actually holding the prize, which is pretty horrendous. And if you then look on the other side, on the right-hand side, this is actually over the past decade, Australia's annual growth in living standards was 0.15%. We are right down at the bottom relative to the US or anybody else you want to look at. So we have a situation where households in real terms are being really badly squeezed in Australia. And, you know, no surprise then that people are finding it difficult to get by.
Well, it's good to see an AFR article that's actually touching on some truth for once and diving into some interesting stuff there. But yeah, I guess it's not more so, I think, that Australia could have, central bank and government should have done more to go into more debt to get our economy going. We had heaps going in yes. terms of our economy.
Yes.
It's just that we've been so poorly managed that it's all gone to overseas and corporations and whatever.
Well, yeah, and that's what Chris's point was. They made massive mistakes, and he goes back 20, 30 years and said, you know, they should have done this, should have done that. We had huge capacity to do so much better than we did. And the politicians are to blame for that. They made bad decisions, short-term decisions, you know, handing a bit more money out here, there and everywhere. And what we've now got ourselves into the situation is that we are actually now looking at significant deficits into the future. In fact, Chalmers did say that the next budget will include, you know, confirm deficits as far as the eye can see. And it's also, we're looking at this chart. This is the disposable income per capita chart. And okay, you can argue that the situation through COVID was that it was artificially high. But even if you actually take that out, you can see there that we are actually really going nowhere at all. So real households on average are actually not doing anything better. But of course, it's not equally spread. And so there are some people who are really, really caught with this at the moment. And I don't know whether you saw, but on the next slide, there's a guy called Morgan Cox. He actually asked a question on Q&A about the housing crisis. And I have to say that the answer, I mean, he's in the rental sector, struggling with making ends meet, et cetera, et cetera. And the answers from the politicians were disgusting. They didn't really want to engage with this critical issue because he linked it to migration and said, look, you know, what about migration? Surely this is something we should be thinking about. Surely we've got too many people coming in. We can't get housing. And so the consequences of this income squeeze that we've seen, the consequences of housing being much more expensive than previously, is actually coming home to hit real people. And he's become a bit of a face of this. In fact, I'm hoping to chat with him later in the week, and if I do, I'll make a show about it. But it was stark to see real people and how badly they were being impacted by some of these decisions now.
100%. And I might share some thoughts before we go to the next slide. But I think this is something we've both touched on, and you have to make the, you know, you have to define what we're talking about. We're talking about immigration and the difference where people say, oh, you know, you're being racist and that type of thing. It's very clear that we should not be taking in, you know, another 200,000 this month or, you know, a million over the past 18 months during a housing and cost of living crisis. And when the politicians say, oh, we need skilled workers, well, the data shows that, you know, it's not a large percentage that are skilled workers at all. And the worry is exactly what we've seen across Europe, which I've been talking about, in places like Ireland and Sweden that were some of the safest countries in the world. And there's no checks on these, a lot of these people that are coming in. And now we see these stats that suggest, you know, 20% of these immigrants are now, a lot of them come from places and they've been radicalized, and we can get into all that. But you know, they're responsible for a huge percentage, 70%, I think, in Sweden, of the violent crime comes from 20% of the, you know, this immigrant population. So there's plenty of nice immigrants out there. You know, we love people from all countries. That's fine. That's not the problem. It's when we get these violent youths and people that don't gel with our culture and whatever that are causing all this trouble. And you can never, you know, in these places where there's a billion people seeking refuge, it doesn't matter if the world takes 10 million. You know, a year, that 1%, when their populations grow by 5%, you're not making any difference really to what's going on. You have to, the individual countries have to have their own structural reforms or whatever. There's no point importing crime and ending up devastating the majority of the Australian middle and lower class just to make this tiny dent. But that's my rant on that topic,
Mark. No, I think it's important, and you know, the consequences have not been fully understood. And it's interesting, Andrew Bragg in Senate Estimates, Senator Bragg, asked a question. There are 2 million, because the Treasury is projecting another 2 million migrants coming in. And he basically asked the question, have you done any modelling to look at how 2 million additional migrants coming into the country is going to impact the housing sector and housing supply, bearing in mind that we're only building 120 or whatever it is a year, you know, target 1.2 million over 5 years, but we're well below. And Treasury said, no, we haven't looked at it. So there is a fundamental problem here that we are not understanding the consequences of these decisions. And I want to skip forward just to a slide on migration, just to show you that the immigration numbers are still very high. Come back slightly, but, you know, they're still very high. And, you know, another 2 million people over the next few years is quite likely. And on the next slide, it's interesting that now we've got overseas student numbers blowing out the water, right? It's an historic high, and a record 200,000 overseas students flooding into Australia in February. So where are all these people going? No wonder we've got a housing crisis, and no wonder we've got some significant issues. And that's the point. There is no joined up thinking here about linking migration to housing, to cost of living, to income growth. All of these things are actually being managed without any sense of putting the pieces together. And that is what needs to be debated in the upcoming election. It won't be, but it should be.
And I don't know if you've joined these dots as well, Martin, but I saw a good tweet by Matt Barry today talking about how there's 5 million Indians in Canada whose, I think, visas are about to expire, and all the stuff that Australia's just done to completely open the doors. So in theory, we could have 5 million people, Indians, come here over the next few years. Again, nothing against those people, but this is the policies we've been putting in place to be completely flooded in a cost of living and housing crisis, as well as, you know, the cultural things and all that that we've been talking about. So this is just wild if, you know, nothing changes.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, of course, if you look at my stress data, it's actually the first generation migrants in the rental sector who are the most stressed of all the segments. So a lot of people, when they come into Australia, they immediately find that those housing pressures, they're caught by them. So, yeah, again, no joined up thinking, no long-term thinking. And when you put all that together, maybe it's not surprising why consumer confidence is down. So the ANZ Roy Morgan, which was came out very recently, dropped 3.1%. It's down again. But what was really interesting here was the inflation expectations rose to 4.8%. So there's an expectation of higher inflation. Of course, that could lead to lots of consequences in terms of more prospective pay demands and those sorts of things. We have not got this DNA right for Australia. And so Chris Richardson's article really, I think, explains why a lot of these things have happened. But I am not seeing any appetite from the incumbent politicians or the opposition parties to want to talk about the real issues that we should be talking about.
Yeah, and so are they going to pull the lever of more risky lending to get us through?
Well, funny that, because, of course, the demand from the banks has been to release those lending taps, let us lend more. Now, APRA came out and said, well, we're not actually going to reduce the BAL rules in Australia, because there's talk about that happening in the US, which won't make the banks very happy. But it is worth noting that CBA, of course, called out CBA before, you know, they came off their highs. They're significantly down. They're still way overvalued. They're still, three times more valuable than most of the other banks around the world, more valuable than JP Morgan. How that can be. Now, of course, the reason is that the banks in Australia are, supported by the government directly and indirectly. They've got their much higher margins than banks around the world. But nevertheless, they were their shares were way overvalued. And in fact, I don't know whether you saw this, but I spoke to Dr. Professor Andy Schlomer the other day, who's the Senate candidate for New South Wales for the Australian Citizens Party. And he actually slayed the banks on my live show yesterday, because he said, look, the banks have actually, they're calling the shots, basically, that they are actually leading the charge in terms of what's wrong with Australia. So if you want to get in a deep dive and work into things, go watch that show. It was quite eye-opening, because he's all about financial regulation and the financial system and what needs to be done. And he speaks very well about some of these issues. But the point is, the banks, they're sucking the blood out of Australia and Australians. We need a different path ahead. We need a path that's actually built around ordinary Australians and ordinary businesses, not just about the highfalutin politicians or the highfalutin bankers.
Awesome. Well, the links to watch that rant and all Martin's work are always down below. Yeah, it's been good to see Senator Rennick and Babbitt. There's a lot of people starting to call out this corruption and the globalist influence on Australian politics. So, Martin, our monthly episode should only get more interesting from here. Appreciate your time, and we'll catch up again next month.
Great. See you again.